From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 8th day of February, 2024. In this morning's USDA World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate, USDA lowered soybean exports by 35 million bushels and put those right onto the ending stocks, pushing them above 300 million. We'll talk about that 315 with Matt Bennett of AgMarket.net, and then we'll take a look at the weather forecast, too, with Mike Tenor at T-Storm Weather, right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.33 1/4, a penny lower. The May down a penny and a half at $4.45. And December corn, that's the new crop, at $4.72 1/4, down 1.5. March soybeans, $11.93 1/2, up 4.5 cents. The May at $11.99 3/4, 2 1/4 higher. And November beans at $11.72 3/4, up 2 cents for the day. Bean meal futures, $4.10 lower. Bean oil up $1.18. Wheat futures, soft red down 13.5, settled at $5.88 1/2, and the hard red at $6.01, down 17 1/4. Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net now joins us to take a look at the USDA reports and the reaction in Chicago. Hi, Matt. Thank you for being with us. Let's start with corn. New contract lows again today?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much an everyday occurrence anymore. It's been, at least lately, it's been kind of frustrating to watch. But, yeah, I would say that, I mean, I don't know if you want to call it a silver lining. I don't know. We closed 3.5 cents off the lows. I mean, that's one good thing. But, you know, the market digested the numbers, traded a little higher, and then you turned around and just had some sell pressure throughout the day. Fortunately, we were able to kind of pick up off those lows and at least settle a little bit better. I think part of that had to do with the fact that, you know, the bean market was able to trade, you know, 2-4 or 5 cent gains, which was a nice thing to see. And then, of course, whenever you look over, you know, some of the other commodities were rallying as well. So energies were strong, which kind of interesting given the fact that the dollar was actually a little bit higher.
I thought as I watched the soybeans, in fact, after the USDA reports came out and decreased U.S. exports by 35 million bushels, put those right into the ending stocks at 315, that they had actually a very good finish to the day. And if you do some of the calculations on what the tech side look like, they got down to what, 64, I think, on new crop. That was kind of the where the bottom target on the trade should have been, I guess, if you were doing the measuring gaps.
Right.
And bounced, that seems like a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we bounced 10 cents off that low that we, you know, established there. We didn't make a new low for this particular part of the move. We're actually very close to making a new for this particular part of the move, but good Lord, you know, it's just been a pretty rough go. I mean, you've got that gap in the chart up there. Oh, I don't know. I'm going to call it around 1240 or so. You know, I think a lot of people have said, hey, you know, can we go back up and test that at some point? I know at our meeting this last weekend out in Nashville, that was a topic of discussion is, you know, is there a chance we could go back up and fill some of these gaps? But yes, it's a fundamental just debacle right now. Most of the fundamentals don't look good for corn or beans. You know, you look at a carry out for beans right now, 315. I mean, that's the most we've seen or traded for quite some time. And so to settle the market higher, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, nice settle. Nice to see beans get back on the positive side of things after what I would call a pretty bearish report. Now, South America, come on. I mean, we dropped 1 million ton. I think CONAB's down to 149. So USDA's easily the highest one right now, which, you know, I don't know. They always slow play it. I understand that. I don't want to try to pinpoint that number, but I think they're way too high given the weather this year.
Yeah. So as I was thinking about this last week, and maybe you have an opinion on this, last Friday seemed like a disaster for soybeans. This Thursday seems like a good thing for soybeans. A lot of time left in this marketplace, though.
Yeah.
What'd you think of that last week?
You know, the thing is you know, when you see how the market reacted last week, I mean, you had a real strong move on Tuesday. Then you turned around, and Thursday and Friday were just horrible. I mean, it just kind of took the wind out of the sails. Most people went home with their hat pulled down low. Definitely was not a pleasant type of feel to this market. And then, of course, you're looking forward to this report and trying to think, hey, what could possibly go right for us on this report? I mean, what bullish information might they give us? And I think everyone knew that they should lower Brazil's crop, but I mean, of course, they barely did. But to be honest with you, last week going home, I mean, I sure hope that tomorrow we don't get some sort of a bearish a surprise as far as the market's trading lower once again. But, you know, if we could settle out the week kind of where we're at right now, I'd call this a major victory compared to what we were feeling like a week ago.
Last weekend, you had your conference in Nashville. How'd that go and what was the temperature there?
You know, it was as far as outside, it was awful nice, and I think people enjoyed it. But as far as inside, you know, I think there was a fair amount of bearishness around. I mean, as you know, we had some awfully good speakers. I mean, we had our good buddy Eric Snodgrass. We had Dan Bozzi and Dave Hightower. You know, Randy Dowdy was even there talking to us about production. And I'll tell you what, there was a lot of great information, but I'd be lying if I said that, you know, there wasn't a fair amount of bearishness. So, you know, I think that most people understand that from a fundamental standpoint, we're really at a challenge situation. And so now how can we maybe manufacture a little bit out of this market? Because there will be some ebb and flow. There will be some opportunities to sell at better points than at other points in the year. It's just a matter of managing it well. So I think the overreaching thing for me is we always have to remember that, you know, these markets and the crop insurance situation, all of it, there's a lot of ebb and flow. We have to know what are we putting into this crop, you know, and put some offers in there. I mean, it would have been nice to see a spike higher today, and we had people with offers in just in case. But if you don't have an offer in, you're not going to catch that spike because these markets trade so quickly. So, yeah, it's a challenge. But I think we had a great time. We had a lot of great feedback, a lot of good speakers there.
Hey, thanks much. We'll talk with you again next week.
Absolutely, buddy.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net. The crop scientists from the University of Illinois have been making their way across the state for the annual crop management conferences. They were in Champaign on Wednesday of this week. Next week, I'll be with them, frankly, in DeKalb. That should be a good meeting on the 15th. That's also Wednesday. Gio Prezafontes, I believe, should be with us there. He joins me today to talk about the presentation he made in Champaign, and I'm sure he'll make as well a portion of this in DeKalb. You can sign up for those still. Just search out Crop Management Conference Education. You find up there are units that you can get, and it's a great day. We will be in DeKalb at the Farm Bureau Building, University of Illinois Extension Building. There, actually in Seneca. So go ahead and make that link there. You can always find it on our website at willag.org, willag.org. Look in the calendar. It's highlighted in red on the 15th day of February. So I do, Gio, want to go through some of your background. You came through the University of Illinois. You're the state agronomist within Extension here. You did a lot of work on cover crops as your PhD, I believe, and you still like to talk about them. And cover crops are an enormous function within the Illinois nutrient loss reduction strategy. Why is it that you're interested in cover crops, and why is the state and should farmers be interested in them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Todd. I think the first question, why am I interested in? I've been working with cover crops since my master program, that 10 years ago. I like working with cover crops because I think it's a very nice in-field management practice that we can get a lot of benefits out of it. And my presentation here today in Champaign, I was trying to cover some of that topic. And of course, we need to think about why we're promoting, why should we consider cover crop in Illinois? And you already answered that with your question, which is a major component on the Illinois nutrient loss reduction strategy. Right. So that's what I talked a little bit about to the audience, trying to make that point to think about why we're promoting this. And I think that will help us, you know, thinking about how can we fit this cover crop into our existing cropping system And I also show research data from some of the work that has been done here in Illinois, not only the work that I did, but other faculty, to kind of, you know, show the point in theory, but also as a proof of concept, showing research data on how can we manage cover crops, how can we get the nutrient loss reduction goals that we're the statewide is trying to achieve. How can we do that and also maintain productivity? So this is a big component of the research that that I'm trying to develop here at U of I, and it's something that I enjoy working with.
There are a couple of things related to the nutrient loss reduction strategy that I think are important. One of them is the private-public partnership, or the partnership between the farmer and the public in general, taxpayers. Sometimes they do pay for things, not always, but sometimes there is. But there's also the private-public partnership, which says these are private lands. However, there are the nation's natural resources. These are private waters. However, they are the nation's natural resources. And waters, usually we refer to as streams and rivers, but those things that might flow into the waters. And that's where I think about this part of the time. And the other is just sheer economics. The plant food, the nitrogen, the phosphorus, the potassium that was put on, is important. It's expensive, and it's there to feed a plant to grow a crop, and you really want to keep it in place. Your suggestion here, and I believe that your work too, proves that this actually helps in the process.
Exactly. So one of the main reasons that we're promoting cover crops in Illinois is to help address nutrient losses. And we've done a lot of work looking at CRI specifically and how they impact nitrient losses. And our data shows that on average, we can get about 30% nitrate loss reduction with a well-managed CRI cover crop when you compare the same system without a cover crop. So yes, we know that we can use the cover crops. They're very effective at reducing losses. There's some management aspect that we need to consider, especially ahead of corn, some extent to soybean. But I think we are able to show that we can fit CRI into our existing cropping systems. And from a sustainability perspective, right? So the goal is to reduce environmental outcomes, maintain profitability and productivity, and this is what our research shows.
So you can manage that. Soybeans, I think, if you talk to cover croppers, not so hard. Corn, pretty difficult. You've been at this longer than most. What are the best tips that you have for producers who are trying to put cover crops into their systems?
For first-time cover croppers or farmers that are thinking about cover crops, I think first and foremost, you need to think about the goals that you're trying to achieve, right? So we can get a lot of benefits from cover crops, like reducing erosion, improving soil organic matter over time, suppressing weeds. The caveat here is that you don't automatically get all those benefits, but you have to identify what are your goals with the cover crops, and then with that, you have to think about what species you want to grow. And if you're thinking about post-soybean, ahead of corn, we don't necessarily recommend you starting with CRI because it takes a little bit more experience. It's fairly easy to kind of mess up the first year. And if you get a yield penalty, you're probably not going to try it again. So if you're trying cover crop or thinking about cover crop before corn, a good way to start is perhaps a mix of oats and radish. Those are relatively easy to manage. We do have to plant them a little earlier, though, to get a good fall emergency establishment. But it's easy to manage because they will likely die over the winter, so you don't have a lot of you don't have to worry a lot in the spring to control and kill that biomass.
Do you have to then think about the soybean crop and maturity on it and when planting date is and all those sorts of things?
Yeah, so one of the things that we are one of the projects that I'm starting now is looking at different maturity groups. So we do have a, if we look at the data from the variety testing trials that has been for a couple of years, I've kind of summarized the past 10 years, and we often see that there is no yield penalty if you reduce your relative maturity by 0.5 units. So these are some of the things that we're going to start looking more into that in terms of, okay, how short can I choose my relative maturity group for soybean without compromising yields, but at the same time, you know, if we can harvest early, we can have more time to plant the cover crop, and the cover crop has more time to get good emergency establishment. So yeah, I think those are some of the considerations to think about. Unfortunately, we don't have research to kind of answer that question, but definitely we have projects that will look into that question.
For those who are conventional tillage, is there much of a difference between making this step and for those that are no tillers or strip tillers because they've already been involved in part of what would be a transition of the farm, I would think.
Yeah, and we actually have data looking at strip till, and most of the time it worked great for us. I really do like the strips because you're prepping the seed bed and you kind of, you know, avoiding that cover crop residue interfering with your planter. If your planter is not set up properly, you can get some establishment issues there. And with the strip till, it worked very well for us. So if a farmer is already doing a strip till, you wouldn't change much in terms of operations. Conventional tillage is kind of hard because you don't have a lot of time to till the field in the fall before you plant a cover crop because you want to plant a cover crop as soon as possible. We do have some research where we looked at, you know, the impacts of tillage, comparing no-till, one pass in the spring, and strip till for both corn and soybeans. We did that for 3 years. We saw yield penalty in one of the 3 years, but in the last 2 years, 2022 and 2023, we didn't see any yield penalty regardless of the tillage system and regardless of having a CRI cover crop.
Is there a place where folks who are interested in cover cropping can go to learn and find more and good, accurate research?
Yes, and this is something that I actually showed on my presentation. Two good websites to keep in mind is one, it's called Midwest Cover Crop Council. So if you Google Midwest Cover Crop Council, you're going to pop up their website. They have plenty of information, plenty of resources that is very good for first timers. In fact, if you go there, you're going to find two bulletins that were put out by Illinois Extension talking about some considerations for cover crop in Illinois. The other website that I really enjoy looking at is the Practical Farmers of Iowa. And the reason I like that is because they show data from their on-farm trials. So this is actual data from all farmer-led research, right? So very practical information, very hands-on information about some of the things that you need to be thinking about and considerations if you're growing cover crops, either before corn or soybean.
Giovanni Prezafontes is the Extension Agronomist for the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I spoke with him at yesterday's Crop Management Conference held at the I Hotel here in town. Let's check in on the global growing regions. We'll do that today with Mike Tenera. He's at T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday again.
Thanks for having me, Todd. Always great being here.
Can we start with wheat production today? It is produced just about everywhere in the world in every month. However, supplies are important, and that's really quite weather dependent. What's the weather been like for the wheat producing areas this growing season so far?
Well, across the northern hemisphere, it's hard to imagine a situation that looks very much better than the one that we have today. You look at the European Union, Russia, and Ukraine, and nearly all of their winter wheat belts were near or wetter than normal over the last 90 days. If we go into China, where they produce a lot of wheat as well, this area typically is very dry in the winter and the spring, with most of their rainfall being driven by what happens later on in the summer, and then they use that for irrigation. Well, they've been getting some good rains too over the course of the winter. We look at India, same kind of story there. They're getting some atypical rains, maybe nothing too major for this time of the year, but they still are getting a little bit of rain, which is unusual and is setting stage for a nice crop there. And then in the US, I mean, in the US, just look around. It keeps raining everywhere. And there's very strong historical support for this type of El Nino to produce one of the biggest hybrid winter wheat crops on record. That's primarily because if you look back in time, you can see that their four highest yielding crops going back to 1960 all happened with this type of El Nino. And it's wet now. There's historical support for it to continue raining. And that would just make for a repeat of that if we can just have basically normal rainfall over the next couple of months.
Let's talk a little bit about South America now, the Southern Hemisphere. A corn crop to be put in the ground. What are your expectations?
Well, there's no real problems at the moment with a mix of dry and wet periods coming up over the next couple of weeks. So that'll just help to get things planted. And it'll be a while before everything is fully planted. That typically doesn't take place till the latter half of March. Once we get deeper into their growing season, which is basically April and May, that's where things will get a little bit dicey more than likely. This type of El Nino that is now fading away does have, or in the past, has produced some pretty dry periods for the northern two-thirds of their corn crop. And that could become an issue once we get 6 to 8 weeks out from now. So we'll see how all of that pans out, but there is some support for a dryness story to develop on that corn crop in the north. In the southern areas, which is primarily going to be located in Paraná, they actually end up with the opposite story. And this is kind of like what we had late last year, where these southern areas end up being super wet and the northern areas end up being super dry. We certainly saw that in 2016, which was the last time we had this type of setup. So that'll be what we watch going forward. But at the time, everything looks okay. And we're just going to have to be aware that this is a possibility once we get closer to it.
And your thoughts about Argentine crops at this time?
Well, the situation there is a little bit tricky. It was real wet and pretty much an ideal scenario into the middle of January. Then all of a sudden it stopped raining and it got really hot over the last week. So they haven't had very much rain until recently in Buenos Aires with some pretty good thunderstorms over the last 2 days. As we move forward, though, a new pattern is developing, and this one is going to be wet. There's quite a bit of rain coming up over the next 2 weeks. This starts today and then continues into the weekend, and then it continues next week in some fashion. So we're looking for 100% to 200% of normal rainfall over the next 14 days. If that happens, then that'll take a lot of pressure off of this year's corn and soybean crop, and we'll be looking at what happens later in February and March. But unless that period were to turn out to be unusually dry and hot, there's really not going to be much concern. Now, there is a little bit of concern again right now with how hot it's been and the lack of rain, but everything is changing back to this wet period.
There are a couple of transitions I'd like you to think about as we finish up our time together. Springtime transition coming at some point still, and then the whole El Niño La Niña events.
Well, that is something that you have to be aware of, though historically it's not a real strong connection to the weather like we have in South America. If you look at the past transitions, it's very likely going to be fairly similar to 4 other years, and those are 1995, as well as 1998, 2010, and 2016. Now, 1995, a lot of people might remember as being a very hot summer, and that is what eventually dinged the corn yield in particular. 1998 wasn't all that hot, even though it had some hot periods. 2010, also a little bit hot in the summer, and 2016 was kind of a mixed bag. Probably the biggest story or the biggest thing to take away from this is that it's unlikely that we'll have a cool summer coming up, or more than likely be normal or warmer than normal. So that might limit the overall potential of the corn and soybean crops. But rainfall, we haven't really been able to find a whole lot there with some dry periods and some wet periods. And that's why if you look at the historical yields, corn and soybeans have done both good and bad in this scenario, with several of them having been pretty much right on the money trend. So it's going to be a little while before we have to think a whole lot about it, but this is not a super strong signal for a big problem ahead. Yes, we have had problems in the past with it, but we also have had some good crops.
Western growing areas, particularly the wheat regions, do better.
Well, they certainly do. The wheat areas certainly do better, but that's just because of what happens between now and the end of May. They typically get a lot of rain, so that could be a limiting factor for corn and soybean planting out in Nebraska. But as far as the wheat crop goes, they should very likely have a pretty good setup here. It's going to take a major pattern change away from the storminess for things to go south for the wheat crop. But once you get deeper into the year, into June, July, and August, all of these things start to break down and it doesn't have as strong of a connection to weather.
Hey, thanks much.
Yep, thanks for having me, Todd.
You're welcome, and thank you. That's Mike Tenurum. He's with T-Storm Weather at tstorm.net online. Helped us to wrap up this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. Came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online at willag.org and register today for the all-day Ag Outlook. That's coming up on Tuesday, the 5th day of March. Details again and a way to register for the $40 event, including your beef house lunch, are at willag.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.